Thank you all very much for coming along this morning. The problem that I want to talk about today, it's basically just one single problem. I want to talk about the question of what physical resources are universal for quantum computation. And I'm going to talk about some work that I've done mostly over the last year or so with these folks here. In particular, I'd like to mention a lot of the work was done with Michael Bremner and Jennifer Dodd. And there's a pretty obvious question why, pretty obvious reason why this is an interesting question, the engineering reason that we'd like to be able to build quantum computers. But I think there's also a more fundamental reason, which is pretty interesting, more interesting to me anyway. And it's got to do with conjecture made by these three guys, Church, Turing, and Deutsch. And in particular, David Deutsch in 1985 made a conjecture that all physical systems can be efficiently simulated on a quantum computer. So if we can answer this question, what physical resources are universal for quantum computation, then we can get some insight into the much more fundamental question of what resources are necessary to efficiently simulate an arbitrary physical system, assuming that this conjecture of Deutsch is in fact correct, which hasn't been shown, but we have no evidence to the contrary. I'm going to talk about three models today, which are universal for quantum computation. The first is the familiar model, and then I'm going to talk about two very different models which are universal for quantum computation, and which I think give new insight into the resources which are required to do universal quantum computation. So the first model, of course, is the one everybody's familiar with, consists of the controlled knot and single qubit unitary gates. Everybody knows you can do quantum computation with this. And the key sort of this model has led people to think that the key element in quantum computation is doing coherent unitary dynamical operations. And usually we think of things like interaction with the environment or measurements during the computation as being bad things. These are things to be avoided. Perhaps the most typical figure of merit which people give for how well a quantum computer is a potential design for a quantum computer is doing is the ratio of the time required to perform one of these single qubit unitary gates or one or two qubit unitary gates and the interaction time, the characteristic time scale for interactions with the environment. However, there's another universal set which tips this completely on its head. In the universal set that I'm going to describe, there's in fact no unitary dynamics whatsoever, except for quantum memory. So we're able to coherently preserve quantum bits through time. And I'm also going to allow us to do two-qubit projective measurements. So when I say two-qubit projective measurements, what I mean is that we've got the ability to perform measurements in an arbitrary basis, not just product state measurements. So when I describe this result, people sometimes say to me, well, what does this give us? Why is this at all interesting? Isn't it just as hard for doing quantum computation to have to be able to do these entangled two-qubit projective measurements as doing two-qubit gates like a controlled knot gate? And you'll get no argument from me. It probably is just as hard doing that. Maybe there's some advantage. I don't know of any in some schemes, but I don't think that's the central point, any sort of engineering advantage. What I think is the essential point is just that we've been incorrect in thinking that unitary dynamics is really the crucial feature of quantum computation. There's an equally good model, which is universal for quantum computation, in which there are no coherent unitary dynamics. We've learned that, in fact, projective measurements alone are sufficient to do universal quantum computation. So let me explain how this works. Before I do that, I'd just like to acknowledge some prior work. In particular, the scheme I'm going to talk about today actually doesn't involve two-qubit projective measurements. It's a little bit more complicated. It involves projective measurements on four qubits. But recently, Debbie Leung has shown that, in fact, that scheme can be simplified down to just requiring two-qubit projective measurements. And I should also mention that there's work done by Rausendorf and Briegel a couple of years ago that is rather closely related. What they showed is that a very similar model is also universal for quantum computation. In particular, their model involved quantum memory. It just involved single qubit projective measurements, but there was an additional resource. They needed a shared array, or they needed an array of qubits prepared in some particular entangled state. So that's an additional resource, but nonetheless, the moral is very similar, namely that having measurements alone can be a very powerful tool, roughly equivalent to the ability to do unitary operations. And also, as Manny Cannell told us this morning, there's also this alternate, there's this model of quantum computation involving linear optics, measurement and preparation of number states, which uses very similar ideas, this idea that measurement can be a powerful primitive in doing quantum computation. Okay, so how does this work? Let me first talk about a slightly different question. This is some work that I did with Ike Chuang a few years ago. In particular, the question, can we build a programmable quantum computer? So there's a fundamental difference in the way we usually think of classical and quantum computers. When we think of a classical computer, we think we've got some data, we've got a program, and then we've got a fixed device which we run to produce the output of the computation. When we think of a quantum computation, we don't think that way at all. There's no program. Instead, there's a varying gate array. We change our computer. So what Ike and I asked is whether or not it might actually be possible to build a fixed gate array that could be used to perform an arbitrary quantum computation. Let me make that a little bit more precise. We've got some data state psi. We've got some unitary operation that we'd like to perform on psi. I'm going to imagine that this is just a single qubit psi, but the same general principles apply in general. And we're going to map this unitary operator into some program state, which I'll label U also. And then I'll imagine that we've got a fixed array, some quantum circuit, and the effect of this array is to produce as output U psi for any unitary operator U, and some other state of the program register, which could potentially depend on U and psi. So if this was done, it'd be great news for sort of potential future software moguls. Unfortunately, it turns out, in fact, to be impossible. There's no way of doing this. This is a result that, with apologies to Deeks, Wooters and Zurich, I like to sometimes call the no programming theorem. In particular, it's fairly easy to show that distinct unitary operators, U1 through UN, actually require orthogonal program states. And since, even for a single qubit, there are an infinite number of different unitary operators, the size of the program register would actually need to be infinite in order to encode all the possible programs. So there's no hope of being able to build such a programmable quantum gate array, except for maybe a small, limited number of unitary operators. Okay. Well, that's a deterministic model that we considered. We also, in the same paper, considered a non-deterministic model. Might it be possible to do it in some sort of a stochastic way? And it turns out, in fact, there's a very simple trick that will let you do it based on quantum teleportation. So how does the trick work? Well, again, we've got this data qubit that we want to apply some operation to. And I'm going to imagine that we will have a two-qubit program. And the way the program state is defined, it's very simple. We simply apply the single qubit operator U to the second qubit of a Bell pair. So that's the definition for our program. And the gate array is actually very simple. It just consists of a Bell measurement on the data qubit and the first qubit of the program. All right, the Bell measurement has outcomes, which I'll call 0, 1, 2, or 3. And I claim, and will shortly explain, that the output of this array is U sigma J times psi. So in particular, in the case when J equals 0, this Pauli matrix is just the identity, and we've correctly performed the unitary operation that we set out to perform on the qubit. Okay. Of course, that only occurs one quarter of the time. The other three quarters of the time, we fail, as you would expect from the no programming theorem, which I mentioned before. Okay. Why does it work? Well, of course, the circuit I showed you is completely equivalent to this circuit with 0, 0, with the Bell state input here, and then a unitary gate applied down here. But this unitary and the Bell measurement act on different qubits, so they commute with one another. And we can imagine, in fact, the unitary was done after the Bell measurement. And if you look at the state down here, what is it? Well, up to this point, all we've done is quantum teleportation. So, of course, the state here must be just the output state from quantum teleportation. In particular, it's sigma j times psi, where j was the result of the Bell measurement. And then we apply the unitary gate U, and we get as output U sigma J times psi. Okay, how does this let us do universal quantum computation with projective measurements? Actually, it's very simple. I'm going to show you, first of all, how to do single-qubit gates, and then you'll be able to see immediately how to do two-qubit gates in this model. Same basic setup. We've got the state psi that we want to do our single-qubit gate U on, and we're going to do a Bell measurement with the outcome J again. I'm going to define four possible states of this two-qubit register here. This is actually going to be the basis that we measure in. And it's not too difficult to see that this is an orthonormal basis. If we'd left off the U here, then it would just be I tensor sigma k acting on the Bell states. And of course, we know that those just give the maximally entangled Bell basis. And applying a unitary operation doesn't change the fact that those states are orthogonal to one another. So this is a reasonable basis of four states, which we could imagine measuring in, at least in principle. So I'm going to imagine that, in fact, we've performed a projective measurement of these two qubits and obtained as the outcome one of these four states. It actually doesn't matter prior to doing the measurement what the state of this register is. If we do a projective measurement in this basis, we're guaranteed that we'll get one of these four states as the output. And it turns out that for the protocol to work, it actually doesn't matter which of the four states it is. Okay, well, we can analyze this just as we did before. It's equivalent to having U sigma k act here as a quantum gate and a Bell state be input here. And then that commutes with the Bell measurement. So we see that the output of the circuit is just U sigma k sigma j times psi. Now, one quarter of the time, j will be equal to k, and these two Pauli matrices will cancel, and we'll be left with the desired gate U psi. Of course, three quarters of the time we screw up, we don't get the right thing. But that, fortunately, we can correct that problem. What happens when we fail? Well, we get this here. The action is U sigma k sigma j, where j is not equal to k. But the nice thing is that we know both j and k. And as a result, we know exactly what this operator is, and it's a unitary operator. So in particular, we can imagine applying the inverse to correct that unitary error. So what we do is, in fact, we repeat the procedure again, but instead of trying to do the gate U, now we try and do the gate U times this error inverse. So we sort of undo the error and do the gate U all at the same time. What happens? Well, it's successful with probability a quarter, in which case we've successfully achieved doing the U on the state psi. Otherwise, we just keep repeating until eventually we succeed in doing this unitary operator U on our qubit. So a failure probability epsilon can be achieved with roughly log 1 on epsilon repetitions of the procedure. Because of the threshold theorem, in fact, we only need to achieve some finite probability of success, about 10 to the minus 4 or so, and it suffices to repeat this just a relatively small number of times in order to achieve a success probability better than that, and then the techniques of fault tolerance can actually be used to reduce the error even further without the need for more repetitions. Okay, so that's how we do single-qubit gates. I'll just mention briefly how to do two-qubit gates, in particular the controlled knot. Basically, we just double everything in the circuit. Really, it's real obvious. We've got our two-qubit input state there. I guess the biggest difference is in how we define this maximally entangled state. So we've got a Bell state shared between this qubit and this qubit, and between this and this, and then we apply this operator to the second two of the qubits to define our basis. It's easy to check this is a maximally entangled basis once again. So we perform that measurement, and at the output, at the end of the day, what we get after we do this Bell measurement, measuring in the Bell basis between this qubit and this qubit and this qubit and this qubit, is just this operation acting on psi. And again, it's a known unitary error. So if we don't succeed, which occurs with probability not three quarters this time, but now 15 over 16, a much higher probability of failure, we can simply repeat until we get the correct unitary operation applied. Okay. So let me just summarize what I've shown. Namely, that an arbitrary quantum computation can be efficiently performed using just quantum memory and four-qubit projective measurements. Well, recently, Fenner and Zhang have reduced four down to 3, and Debbie Leung has in fact reduced it even further down to 2-qubit projective measurements. What she does is she takes the projective measurement, the 4-qubit projective measurement that I'd need to do the controlled NOT gate, and she just decomposed it into a sequence of 2-qubit projective measurements. I should actually say this surprised me quite a lot that this was possible. I thought it would be impossible, and I spent quite a while searching for an impossibility proof. Quite a bit more time actually than I spent looking for a protocol. I really didn't think it would be the case, but Debbie's found a very nice little sequence of gates, and I recommend you look at the paper. Anyway, now, of course, an obvious problem is whether or not there's actually a practical variant of this scheme. I don't know of any such. The fact that it's only 2-qubit measurements suggests that, well, you know, maybe it's not so hard. Certainly 4-qubit measurements, I think, would be absolutely impossible. 2 qubits is not so bad. A more general problem, or a problem maybe sort of deeper in some fundamental sense, is the question, what sets of measurements are actually sufficient to do universal quantum computation? The measurements that I've described are measurements in maximally entangled bases. Yeah, might it be that in fact it always needs to be a measurement in a maximally entangled basis in order for it to be universal for quantum computation? My suspicion is actually the answer is no. It's probably sufficient to do it in non-maximally entangled bases. Anyway, this seems to me like a very interesting sort of direction for further work. Okay, so that's the first model that I wanted to talk about, the first alternate model. The second alternate model is much closer in spirit to the conventional way we think about quantum computation. In particular, the dynamics now are coherent once again. What I'm going to imagine is that I've been given a Hamiltonian acting on n qubits. I'm going to assume it's a two-body Hamiltonian. That's actually very important. It's going to be entangling in some sense that I'll make a little bit more precise below, but you know, basically it means I can generate entanglement using that Hamiltonian. And it turns out that by alternating periods of evolution due to that Hamiltonian H with single qubit gates, we can actually efficiently simulate an arbitrary quantum computation. Doesn't matter what it is. Now the procedure which I'm going to describe, it's a little bit like this measurement procedure. It's not terribly practical. On the other hand, you know, even while it's not practical, it does settle an important point of principle. It tells you that it doesn't matter what interactions you have in your system, provided they generate entanglement, that you know, you can do universal quantum computation with them, at least in principle. It's up to you to come up with a really good scheme, but there's no longer any doubt. Okay, let me be a little bit more precise about what I mean by an entangling Hamiltonian. So I'm going to expand my Hamiltonian in terms of single-body terms here and two-body terms here. And then, associated with any such Hamiltonian, we can imagine a graph. So all a bond means between two vertices representing the qubits is that there's some interaction term here. And when I say an entangling Hamiltonian, what I mean is that, in fact, this graph is connected. Obviously, if it wasn't connected, imagine we just, you know, these two were connected and these four were connected, it would never be, there'd never be any possibility of generating any entanglement between this component and this component, so it couldn't possibly be universal for quantum computation. But provided it is, there is such a bond, it's always possible to do universal quantum computation. I should mention before I forget that although all the results I've stated and the construction I'm going to show you is for qubits, in fact, all the same things are true for higher dimensional systems, at least in the case of finite dimensional systems, and I'm sure for infinite as well, although we haven't looked at it. The constructions are considerably more complicated. In the qubit case, it's really very simple. Okay. Acknowledgements. I actually started writing out a list of papers which pertain to this problem, and I stopped when I got to about a dozen. Instead, I thought I'd just mention the names of some of the groups that have worked on problems related to this, the Bristol group, the IBM group, the Innsbruck, Karlsruhe, LANL, MIT, and UQ groups, mostly over about the last 12 months or so, although there is also some earlier work, most of it related to NMR and techniques of refocusing. Okay, Let me explain how it works. Basically what we're going to do, the procedure that we're going to use, is we're going to take this basic Hamiltonian that we've got and the ability to do local unit trees, and we're going to gradually build up a library of other things that we can simulate until we build up our library to the point where we can simulate an arbitrary Hamiltonian. Okay? Imagine that, I'm going to do this with basically three observations. Imagine we can simulate evolution to some due to some Hamiltonian J, and we can perform unit trees U and U dagger. Should actually think of these unit trees as being local unit trees, or that's the way I'm always going to use it. And it turns out we can exactly simulate evolution due to UJ, U dagger, just because of this identity here. If we wanted to simulate evolution due to that Hamiltonian, we'd just perform U dagger, then evolve according to J for time T, and then perform U. So we can always conjugate. Observation B is that if we can simulate evolution due to J1 and J2, then we can also simulate evolution due to the sum of those terms. And of course that's true because we have this approximate identity where we've got error terms of order delta squared, which can be made small by choosing delta sufficiently small. That's actually the main thing which makes this scheme impractical. We need to choose delta very small, so we need to do a heck of a lot of simulation, a heck of a lot of different things in order to build up our unitary operations. And finally, the obvious observation that if we can simulate evolution due to J, then we can exactly simulate evolution due to alpha J for any positive alpha. Okay, these are all three very trivial observations, but if you put them all together in the context which we've got, where we've got a single fixed Hamiltonian and also the ability to do local unitary operations, what it tells us is that we can take any positive linear combination of that Hamiltonian conjugated by local unitaries, and we'll also be able to simulate that Hamiltonian. And it will turn out that that's everything we need to do universal quantum computation. So let me explain how that works. Let me start with a two-qubit example. Imagine that we've got this Hamiltonian. Well, just observe that if we conjugate by an x on the first qubit, then the sign of the first and the third change because x anticommutes with z while the second is left alone. So when we sum h with the conjugate of h by x on the first qubit, these two terms disappear and we're just left with the second term, x tends to z. Of course, any tensor product of Pauli matrices can be written as x tends to z conjugated by local unitaries. So yeah, we can also simulate sigma j tends to sigma k. And furthermore, we can also achieve a sign change by conjugating by an appropriate local unitary on the first qubit. So we can also simulate minus sigma j tends to sigma k. And an arbitrary desired two-qubit Hamiltonian k can be written as a positive linear combination of all these different things, which we know how to simulate. So we can simulate an arbitrary two-qubit Hamiltonian. Let me talk a little bit about the general two-qubit case. So now we've got an arbitrary linear combination of products of Pauli's. Let's just choose the largest entangling term. I'm assuming that there is some entangling term. And, there's an identity here, which it's worth going through. Let me just point out a few things about sort of the structure of this identity. It's of exactly the right form, which we know how to simulate. All these terms down here correspond to local unitary rotations because they only act on a single qubit. So we're able to simulate evolution according to each of these terms, but we're also able to simulate evolution according to each of these terms because they're just local unitaries conjugating H. So provided you accept this identity, you have to accept that we can simulate evolution according to sigma r tends to sigma s. Now, why is the identity true? It's actually pretty easy to see. First of all, imagine that H was just sigma r tends to sigma s. Well, if you looked at each of these terms in here, each sigma j tends to sigma k commutes with sigma r tends to sigma s. So you just, you could pull this through, it would cancel over here, and you just get a whole bunch of combinations of sigma r tensor sigma s. Now if we considered, which would give you sigma r tensor sigma s. Now if you considered another tensor product of Pauli operators, sigma j tensor sigma k, two of the terms here would commute, two of the sigma j tensor sigma k would commute, and two of them would anti-commute, so you'd pick up a minus sign, they'd cancel out, and you'd be left with zero. All the single body terms in H are also cancelled out just by these terms down here. So that's how That's the reason why this identity holds. And of course, now once we've got this identity, we can proceed exactly as before to build up an arbitrary desired Hamiltonian K in a form which we know how to simulate. Okay, so that's the 2-qubit case. Of course, I claimed the result was true for n qubits. And in fact, that's really the hard part in some sense, showing that the result is true for n qubits. I forgot. I wanted to talk a little bit about the errors before I talked about the n qubit case. So we made this approximation earlier on when we wanted to get sums of Hamiltonians. I'll just tell you the results. To get a 10 to the minus 3 accuracy in our gate, we need to get, in particular in a C0, we need roughly 10 to the 7 operations. That's a heck of a lot. So obviously this is not particularly practical. If we use higher order simulation techniques, so instead of just doing this simple identity which I showed you, you can have more complicated identities which give you errors of order delta cubed or delta to the fourth or whatever, it's not too difficult to achieve that accuracy using roughly 10 to the 4 operations. And if instead of using that specific Hamiltonian, the general Hamiltonian, you use, a more specific Hamiltonian and exploit some of its structure, well, quite often you're able to get down the number of operations down even further, maybe to 100 or so, between 100 and 1,000. Obviously, this is still not especially practical, but it's a considerable improvement over 10 to the 7. A couple of points I'd like to make. I guess the big one is about fault tolerance. I'll leave that. This is only meant to be an in-principle demonstration. It's certainly not meant to be a practical technique. Finding a practical technique is an interesting open problem. Okay, let me explain now how the results extend to n qubits. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to split my system up into 2 qubits, the principal system P, and then the remainder of the qubits, the other n-2. And I'll imagine that my Hamiltonian has an interaction term between these 2 qubits, and maybe a whole lot of interaction terms within S and also between P and S. And what I want to do is I want to turn off all of the interactions internal to S and between S and P, just leaving some internal interaction within P, which I can then exploit to do something like a controlled NOT gate, and which, by using standard techniques of quantum computation, then I can show is universal for quantum computation. Now, the first thing that you might wonder is why can't we just use the techniques that I described earlier to turn off all the interactions between S and P and internal to S? It's a good question. Well, the reason why is because there's a constant factor overhead at each step of the simulation. So each time you, for example, turn off an interaction between S and P, there's some constant overhead. But there could be as many as n squared interactions here. So if you just turned them all off separately, you'd get a constant raise to the power of n squared overhead, and that's exponential, so that would be no good. So you need to do something a little bit more clever. Fortunately, there's a simple hierarchical construction that can actually be used to turn off all of these unwanted couplings. Let me introduce some notation. X sub S is just the tensor product of X operators acting on system S bitwise. I'm going to use similar notations for Y, Z and other systems. Let's take a look at this Hamiltonian, which by the rules I've been using before, we were able to simulate. What terms appear in here? Well, if you look at it, you'll see that clearly it leaves all the terms in P invariant, because XS, YS and ZS commute with all of them. It eliminates all the couplings between P and S, because two of these, for any given coupling between P and S, two of these terms will commute with it and two of them will anti-commute with it, so you'll pick up minus signs and they'll cancel. And similarly, all single qubit terms in S are eliminated, and it turns out that also all asymmetric couplings in S, terms, couplings like X tensor Y, are also eliminated for the same reason. Okay, well that's great. We've gotten rid of a whole bunch of these couplings in just one step, order N. Operations are actually required here. Now, what we do to complete the procedure is we start dividing this system up into two parts, this remainder system S, S0 and S1. Well, we do a very similar procedure now, except instead of S appearing here, we have S naught on each of them. And what happens is that this leaves the Hamiltonian on P invariant, again for exactly the same reason, and it eliminates all couplings between S naught and S1, once again because you get this cancellation property, two things commuting, two things anti-commuting. All right, we repeat once more. We divide and conquer, and we're able to eliminate all the couplings between this guy and this guy, and between this guy and this guy. And you just keep repeating, and eventually you're actually able to eliminate all of the internal couplings over here, and you've already eliminated all the couplings between P and S. How many times do we need to repeat this? Well, we only need to repeat it roughly log n times. So the total number of operations scales, in fact, as 4 to the log n, which is n squared, times some constant overhead. Well, actually, it's not constant. It's an overhead of n, which is required to perform each step here. Okay. Oh, excuse me. I should say, this really completes the description of the simulation technique. We're now able to perform our controlled knots on the pairs of qubits, which are coupled by this Hamiltonian. And since we can also do local unitary interactions, we're able to perform universal quantum computation. Okay, and finally, well, once again, we've got this problem, just as in the earlier case of the measurement scheme, of whether or not we can turn this from being a method of, in principle, into a practical scheme for doing quantum computation. And I'd especially like to mention the work of the Bristol IBM and Innsbruck groups at this point. They've done a lot of work actually on figuring out what sort of the optimal simulation techniques are in this sort of context. A lot more remains to be done before you could actually call them practical, but I think it's encouraging that progress is being made. More generally, I'd just like to conclude my talk with the comment, sort of summarising the whole talk, which is that it seems to me, at least, as though very little is actually needed to do universal quantum computation in some sense. Almost any set of operations, or it certainly looks to me as though we're moving towards a situation where almost any set of operations, provided there's not a lot of uncontrolled coupling to the environment, can actually be used to do universal quantum computation. And I think it'd be very interesting over the next few years to see exactly how far we can actually go in this direction, further simplifying these measurement schemes and so on and so forth. Thank you very much for your attention.
We have a lot of time for questions, and here's the first one.
Oh, it's certainly, all of this is certainly closely related to that literature. I should say, when we started working on this, we weren't even aware of the existence of that literature, although we're gradually becoming familiar with it. I'm not sure I could give you a really precise answer in my current state, so I might try. Yep. Yep. Not as far as I'm aware. I haven't actually thought about the question. It would certainly, it's an interesting question. It's an interesting question to which I don't know the answer. Certainly off the top of my head, it doesn't look all that good. There's probably some scheme. Certainly in two dimensions, I wouldn't be at all surprised if you could do it. That seems very likely to me, but in one dimension, you might have more difficulty. Perhaps I might just take this opportunity to make a related remark, which is about fault tolerance. It's not directly related to your question. I'd just like to comment that in that measurement scheme, there is actually a threshold. However, it's substantially, if you just do the naive construction, the threshold is substantially worse than the standard threshold. If you assume that the standard threshold is about 10 to the minus 4, and then just use this model to simulate that construction, you get a threshold of about 10 to the minus 7 or so. So that's another direction which it would be very interesting to pursue, to see whether or not you can actually obtain sort of a direct threshold in this measurement model, which might be substantially better.
Next question.
So, given your results on two body entanglement, you will come using measurements, would you conjecture that any entangling quantum operation, like quantum operation, would be universal for quantum computation?
Yeah, I think that something like that is true. Let me explain. First of all, there's a caveat. The caveat is a result due to Dan Gottesman and Manny Cannell, which is that we know that there are certainly instances where you've got entangling operations, but it's not universal. So if you've got the set, you know, Hadamard controlled knot phase gate and measurement, you can efficiently simulate that on a classical computer. With that said, I think that there's probably is some sort of conjecture along your lines which is true. What I think is probably necessary in order to achieve it, in particular, imagine you were given the ability to measure in some basis, but it wasn't maximally entangled. I think you'd need to do some sort of encoding along similar lines to the work which people have done on using the exchange interaction to do universal quantum computation. But I haven't actually worked those ideas out in detail.
Robin.
That's not a rumor, that's a fact. The question is whether or not if imagine we were just given the Hamiltonian x tensor x tensor x, three-qubit Hamiltonian, produces entanglement, three-body Hamiltonian. Can you do universal quantum computation with that? And the answer is no, that and local unitaries. What's the reason for that? Well, I can tell you sort of the mathematical reason. If you look at what's actually possible with all of these you've got that interaction plus the ability to do local interactions, then in fact the total space of things that's actually accessible to you is just the Lie algebra generated by that three-body Hamiltonian plus the local Hamiltonians. And if you think about it, by taking those operators and taking commutation and commuting them, you're never going to be able to get a two-body term. Right? That's basically the fundamental reason. Physically, I don't know. Now, I'd just like to come back to Andrew's question a little bit and say that even though it's not possible to do an arbitrary unitary operation on those three qubits using those three-body Hamiltonians, I still think that there'll be some sort of sense in which you can encode and do universal quantum computation. But again, I haven't worked that with you. Yeah, sure. Let me come in. So in that particular instance, in that particular case, x tensor x tensor x, it's easy. If you've got a more general Hamiltonian, it's not necessarily the case because that extra state may not be stable. That's the problem. Anyway. I actually can't hear the question. Sorry. Yeah, that's right. That's exactly right.
if there are no further urgent questions, let us thank all of the speakers of the morning session and adjourn.